This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Brood 10, the batch of cicadas that emerge every 17 years, set to join us on the surface in the coming weeks, maybe days. They'll be with us for roughly 6 weeks, and there will be a lot of them. WVXU has teamed up with local cicada expert Dr. Gene Kritzky, a professor and dean at Mount St. Joseph University, for this 10-part podcast, Brood 10, the Cicada Podcast. It premieres next week. Dr. Kritzky is with us now live to talk about that podcast and to talk about cicadas. Dr. Kritzky, thank you for being with us.
It's glad to be here.
And if you're listening and you've got questions or comments or observations about cicadas, we want to hear from you too, and you can join us. 513-419-7100 or email your thoughts to talk at wvxu.org. Dr. Kritzky, I'm going to be selfish here to start. I posted on social media last week that I have cicada anxiety, and I'm quite concerned about these swarms, and I'm hoping that we can start by just having you calm me down a bit and tell me there's nothing to be worried about.
There's nothing to be worried about. in reality, one of the things that the periodical cicadas, they don't swarm in the same sense that bees swarm. They do come out in big numbers, but they're not all swarming like a swarm of locusts or a honeybee swarm, for example. It's just the sheer numbers. So it's generally inaccurate to call them a swarm.
But well, that's fair. I'm thinking back to 2004, the last time that we saw this brood, and it's hard to remember the early 2000s for a variety of reasons, but I do recall certainly seeing just a whole bunch of them around my face in, like, Walnut Hills, and I know that we're going to see, you know, crowds of them to varying degrees, depending on which part of the region in which we find ourselves, but they're not going to hurt us, right? I mean, they're not here to bite us or to do anything bad to us.
That's correct, Michael. They're not going to bite. They're not going to sting. They're not going to carry away your small children. They are just this wonder of nature that you can anticipate 17 years in the future.
Well, what exactly is going on? I mean, this is quite a natural phenomenon for them to emerge like clockwork in such a strange, timely fashion. What are they doing?
Well, right now they're basically underground waiting for two things. One, the right environmental conditions. They're waiting for the ground temperature to reach 64 degrees Fahrenheit. And they're also finishing up their maturation. I've received with the phone app Cicada Safari several photographs, about 100 or so per day. And people are finding them in their garden as they're planting flowers and other things. And they don't have these characteristic black patches behind the head, which you see on the day that they emerge. So they're developing those. And once those develop, and then the right soil temperature hits, then they'll pop.
I'm noticing some pictures on social media of what appear to be tunnels. So, I mean, is it infrastructure week underneath the surface for the cicadas, or are they preparing for their exit?
Well, those tunnels have always been there. It just happened that a little over a week ago, we had a day that we had rain almost all day long. And when the ground gets really wet and almost saturated with water, they'll extend their tunnel with little things called what we call chimneys or turrets. And I've received hundreds of photographs now and have seen several thousand from all these photographs, but they basically are trying to keep above the water that's collecting in their tube their tunnel. And then they just extend that up eventually. And now those have broken off, the tops have broken off, and there are still holes there that you're seeing, but they probably plugged the hole. They're still down there, but they've sort of sealed it off further down.
So the cicadas are going to be here for about 6 weeks once they emerge. And what are they doing while they're on the surface with us?
Well, the first thing they're going to do is when they crawl out of the tunnels in the evening, right for sundown, is to transform into an adult. And that's one of the great things to watch. It's a wonder of nature. You'll see these things by the hundreds crawling up on trees and blades of grass and walls and what have you. And then they stop, lock themselves with their little claws at the end of their legs, and holds them fast and tight to the surface. And then that brown skin, that's their nymphal skin, splits starting at the thorax at the back. And then the white, creamy white adult insect with its red eyes comes emerging out of that skin. They'll first sort of be sort of sticking out toward the top. And then they literally hang almost upside down, being held in place just by the tension of that little opening on the old exoskeleton, their old nymphal skin. And then after that takes about 20 more minutes, they'll harden their little claws. They'll do a sit-up, grab a hold of the skin, free their abdomen. And now they look like a creamy white insect with red eyes and shrivel up little wings. And then it takes another, 45 minutes or so, but they'll expand the rest of the wings. They'll fill them with fluid, and that'll expand them. Now we have a typical looking cicada, but it's all white. They're all white with these red eyes. And then another hour and a half later, they'll appear with what we normally would expect to see. And that's a red-eyed, black-bodied cicada with its membranous wings with orange wing veins and orange legs.
Okay, and what's their purpose while they're up here? Why spend this 6 weeks above the ground?
Well, the primary reason for that is the same as is for all species. That's just to reproduce. And so when they come out, they're going to, after that first night that they come out, it's going to be eerily quiet for the next several days, because it takes about 5 more days for them to completely harden their exoskeleton. Then they'll start flying around, and then they start singing. And so after they've come out, you wait about 5 days to a week after they've emerged from the ground, then you'll start hearing these calls, this loud chorusing. And what's happening are these males are collecting in trees in what we call chorusing centers, and they all start singing. Females hear it. They fly into the tree, and then if a female is close enough to a male, she'll actually respond. She doesn't have the sound-producing structures that the males do. She will respond by flicking her wings at a precise moment in his call. And if he hears it, he'll turn and face her and call again. She'll flick her wings again. He gets closer. Process continues. Then they'll go to a secondary call and then a tertiary call where they start mating.
Well, that almost sounds romantic. So the noise that we hear, is it all the male cicadas only?
It's only the male cicadas. And why it seems rather cacophonous is that while one male is singing and attracting a female, a second male nearby will sometimes start to sing in the middle of that first male's call so that the female can't hear that point in the call where she should flick her wings.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask about that next, because we know there's a ton of these bugs that are coming out of the earth, but what type of competition do they each face amongst themselves in trying to find a mate?
That's the primary competition, of course, is reaction by the female to the calls, and males will try to interfere with that. If they're not successful, let's say after calling 3, 4, 5 times, the unsuccessful male will fly to another tree or another branch. And then if you remember back when they were here before in 2004, the intensity of the calls is really loud. It can get up to about, I've measured it, 96 decibels. But every once in a while, you'll see it, that the intensity, the loudness will drop down to the low 80s. And then it gets back up again. And if you watch when that sound level, that intensity drops and look at the trees, you'll see the males are flying all over the place trying to find a new vantage point. It's like a gigantic cicada singles bar. If you're not lucky at the bar there, you go to the bar across the street.
Indeed. Wow, that's very clever. Okay, 513-419-7100 is the number to call. If you've got questions or comments about cicadas, let's go to the phone lines now where we find Patrick. Hi, Patrick. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I had a question. I've heard that the cicadas are actually edible, and so I was wondering if there's anything special we'd have to do to prepare them to make them ready for human consumption.
All right, Patrick, I'll hang up and let Dr. Kritsky answer that question. Dr. Kritsky, it sounds like Patrick's got an appetite for cicada.
It sure does, and they are edible, but you want to get them at the right time. And I shall tell, in full disclosure, I have eaten them. I don't eat them anymore because, well, they got me tenure. So I'm somewhat protective now of them. But it turns out if you want to consume some, my undergraduate advisor made it a point to eat every insect that his study group ate to see why they were eating them, if they're tasty or not. You want to get them while they're still white, while they're coming out of the shell. That's called a tenural condition, because the exoskeleton hasn't hardened. If you get them after they turn dark, it's like eating the tail end of the shrimp that you hold onto while you dip the shrimp in the cocktail sauce. It's sort of that sort of paper parchment-like material. It's very thick and it's not easy to digest. Of the two, it's better. There's more nutrition in the female cicadas than the male cicadas, because two reasons. One, the male cicada's abdomen is mostly hollow and it's used as a resonating chamber to help make the sound a little louder. The female, on the other hand, she is filled with eggs. I had a student count all the eggs in several hundred cicadas, and we found that the average right around 500, a little over 500 eggs per female. And so her abdomen is filled with these eggs, which of course has the food source for the embryonic cicadas and so on.
What do they taste like? Can we compare it to anything?
Well, the ones I've had, and I've had them in several ways. I've had them just blanched in a salad. I've had them deep fat fried. I've had them sautéed in a stir fry. I've also just had them you know, just sort of cook quickly and then put in cocktail sauce, like you have a shrimp, for example. They, to me, because they're plant feeders, they feed on the xylem. That's take everybody back to their biology classes in the past. That's the water conducting tissue from the roots that take water and minerals up to the leaves, and they're feeding on this dilute juice. So they have a very green flavor because they are herbivores. And to me, if I was to pick a comparison taste, it's cold canned asparagus.
Wow, way to sell it, Dr. Krinsky. I'm not sure how curious people are going to be to sample that, but you never know. I mean, there's got to be some type of predator out there that's anxiously awaiting the emergence, right? Some natural eaters of the cicadas.
Oh, there are many predators out there, but they're not necessarily anxiously waiting because they don't really know. That's the whole thing about
cicadas. They don't read your blog.
Well, that's right. they come out once every 17 years for brood 10. That no predator can really evolve a dependency on cicadas or looking forward to these cicadas occurring. But when they do come out, they're an opportunistic food source. And that pulse of its additional food is you can see things like dogs, cats, raccoons, mice, birds by the hundreds eat these things. I've seen photographs of geese feeding on them. We've even had reports that during hunting season, turkey season, the male turkeys taken during season in an area where there's been a cicada emergence have a slightly larger than average body weight.
Oh, so they're kind of a fat source.
So, but they have a reasonable amount of fat content, but they're opportunistic, which is very helpful. So, for example, let's say you got mice eating these, and you have an increased reproduction of mice. Well, that additional mice, those will in turn be fed on by owls and the other and hawks, and so it can go through the food chain. This sort of pulse of food will then help all sorts of animal populations build up more population numbers in once every 17 years.
The cicadas that we're going to see who are up here trying to find a date, do they die at the end of this cycle?
Yes, they do. They die shortly after mating, in fact, and the female dies shortly after she lays all of her eggs. And the average cicada lives unless they're eaten as soon as they come out, and I've seen them fly from one tree to another and get grabbed by blue jays in the middle of flight. But if they're able to live out of the normal life expectancy of the adult, which is about a month. And it takes about 2 weeks for all the cicadas to actually emerge from the ground. So once they start emerging in good numbers until the last time we see it, it's about 6 weeks. But the ones that are dying at the end, they came out later in the emergence.
Okay, and so they reproduce, they lay their eggs. What happens for 17 years after those eggs are laid?
Certainly. The eggs are laid in the terminal branches of trees. And they go for stems that are about the size of a pencil. And the eggs are laid by the females in clusters of 10 to 20 for every quarter inch of an egg nest. Then she walks another quarter inch and lays more eggs. And she does that. They're under the bark. She actually has an egg-laying structure that will saw into the portion of the branches. Those eggs take 6 to 10 weeks to hatch. So come starting in the middle of July into the early part of August, the eggs will be hatching. As soon as those nymphs, they're about 2 to 3 millimeters long. They're not very big at all. And they're really cute when they're small. they crawl out of the egg nest and literally just sort of free fall down to the ground. Because while they're in the trees, even though they're very small, spiders and beetles and ants go after them like crazy. So as soon as they hit the ground, they want to get to the soil as fast as they can. They'll crawl down a blade of grass, let's say, for example, and they'll find that crack in the soil where the grass is growing through the soil. They get down there almost immediately, and they'll feed on grass roots for the next few weeks. And then by New Year's Day, they're going to be 8 to 12 inches below the surface feeding on a tree root. And that's where they'll be for the next 17 years.
Do they have a community down there? I mean, do they interact with one another?
It doesn't appear that they do. I've dug up many cicadas. I got to do something in between these years that emerge. I usually find just one tunnel. You find them in isolation. You don't find more than one tunnel. You might find tunnels next to each other, but there's no evidence that they're interacting.
Well, tell us about this app before we take a quick break. I know that if people, we've got a link at wvxu.org inside the Cincinnati Edition tab to drive people to check out this Cicada Tracker app.
Certainly. It's called Cicada Safari, and it was developed by the Center for IT Engagement at Mount St. Joseph University. And I'm really touched that they would develop this for me. But it's a, it's an app to help us get a sense about where are the cicadas emerging. And the app is free. There's no tracking on it, no in-app purchases. It's available for the iPhone and Androids. And what we want people to do is to download the app and then go on their own cicada safari. When they see a cicada, they photograph it. And when they submit the photograph is the voucher, the verification that they're looking at a periodical cicada. Those photographs are all examined by human eyes to make sure they're truly cicadas. And then the photograph has embedded in the metadata the date, the time, longitude, and latitude. And if they're approved, they go on our live map, which is on the app as well. We also have it online at Cicada Mania, for example. And you can follow the emergence when it starts in northern Georgia and follow it as it moves north as the season progresses. It's really cool. But we're as of this morning, we have 45,000 people have downloaded this app already.
Wow.
And we're adding about 1,500 a day. And we're really concerned about where is Brood 10? Because believe it or not, back in the 1890s, the USDA was worried that Brood 10 might go extinct because of clear cutting for agriculture, clear cutting for urbanization, and so on. That was brought out even in 1919. The USDA had a major press release that we're worried about Brood 10 going extinct. You know, the locusts will be extinct in time. And then my research that I had that worked with my undergraduate advisor, Frank Young, and I have been monitoring what's going on in Ohio and Indiana. And we do see areas where cicadas are becoming much more patchy in their distribution. Usually, for example, in Ohio, the northwest part of Ohio, half the counties have lost cicadas that they once had. The other, where they do exist, occurs in these little pockets here and there. And so we are seeing a decline in parts of Brood 10's distribution. So, and as crazy as it sounds, Brood 11 went extinct in 1954. So cicada broods have disappeared. And so we're trying to get a nice baseline of all the locations where Brood 10 occurs so we can monitor that that the stability of the population over the next 17 years and on.
We'll explore some more cicada history just ahead, and we'll get to some more phone calls as well. 513-419-7100 if you want to join us. Email talk at wvxu.org. We'll take a quick break. We'll have more with Dr. Gene Kritzky just ahead. Here's a trailer for the upcoming podcast series to be featured on WVXU.
Brood 10 is coming.
May 19th, 1715. In this month, some singular flies came out of the ground. The English called them locusts. When they left the ground, holes could be seen everywhere in the roads, and especially in the woods. They were encased in shells, out of which they crawled. It seemed most wonderful how, being covered with the shell, they were able to burrow their way into the hard ground. When they began to fly, they made a peculiar noise, and being found in great multitudes all over the country, their noise made the cowbells inaudible in the woods. They were also destructive, making slits in the bark of trees where they deposited their worms, which withered the branches. Swine and poultry ate them, but what was more astonishing, when they first appeared, some people split them open and ate them, holding them to be the same kind as those said to have been eaten by John the Baptist.
That's right, the emergence of the 17-year periodical cicadas known as Brood 10 is upon us. Cincinnati Public Radio has teamed up with one of the top experts in periodical cicada research and observation, Dr. Gene Kritzky of Mount St. Joseph University, to bring you this 10-part series teaching you everything you ever wanted to know about the science, history, and cultural influence of this emergence of billions of winged bugs across the eastern United States. I'm WVXU reporter Corey Sharber, and since this is my first experience of the Brood 10 emergence, I'll be learning about this fascinating phenomenon of nature right alongside you, the listener, as Gene teaches us how to stop worrying and learn to love the bug. We'll have new episodes available throughout the emergence of Brood 10 this spring and early summer, every Tuesday starting April 27th. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts and join the conversation by sending your questions or recording a message for Gene and our team via email to broodx, as in the Roman numeral for 10, at wvxu.org or using the Talk to Us feature on the WVXU app. We hope you'll join us on this journey, brought to you by Cincinnati Public Radio.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now our cicada chat with Dr. Gene Kritzke of Mount St. Joseph University. Dr. Kritzke, I got to say the phone lines are blowing up, so we're going to go right to the phone lines now. Jackie's on the line. Hi, Jackie. What's your question or comment?
Yes, doctor. Thanks for taking my call. You may have alluded to it already. Right now, I see emerging what we call, I guess, the Cincinnati lizards or geckos or whatever those things are coming out right now, too. And I'm wondering, how are those going to interact with the cicadas? Do they eat the cicadas? Do the cicadas try to get in? What's the interaction between those two insects?
All right, Jackie, we'll hang up and we'll let Dr. Kritzke address that. What about those, I guess, those speedy little lizards we see running around the city? How will they interact with the cicadas?
I believe you're referring to the wall lizards or the Lazarus lizards that we see that have moved. I first moved here. I only found it on the east side of town, just east of downtown. And now we have here in Delhi and Westwood and so on. They do eat insects, but in many cases, the periodical cicadas may be a little bit too big for a lot of those. So the interaction would be relatively minor, it looks like. So they're not going to have a big impact on the population, I would suspect.
All right, let's go back now to the lines where we find Phil. Hi, Phil, what's your question or comment?
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious about what kind of damage we can expect to plant life. We've got a young apple orchard that we've planted over the course of the last 3 years or so, and I'm really worried about how we're going to be able to protect all the trees. We've got about 300 trees we're trying to figure out how to protect.
Okay, Phil, we'll hang up and let Dr. Kritzke answer that. Phil's concerned about his small, young apple orchard.
Certainly. Phil's not online, but basically, if your trees are more than 5 feet tall, they'll probably do fine. It also depends on how close is just planted these. There's going to be no cicadas will be emerging underneath them because they haven't laid eggs in the trees yet. So it depends on how close you are to an established population. If there's a large population within a mile, there could be some individuals fly in. But basically, unless your tree is a new sapling and relatively small, we don't expect a lot of significant damage. Now, they will, if they do get some egg laying, oviposition going on, some of those branches may break. But in 1869, a paper was published in the American Entomologist, and the title was "Out of Evil Cometh Good." And it turned out orchardists in Illinois and Missouri noticed that they had a bumper crop, one of the biggest yields they've ever had. And it was realized that the cicada egg laying was like a natural pruning that actually increased the flower set the following year. And I've seen that, and I've surveyed trees, and that I've got some anecdotal evidence that indeed does happen. So if you do get a little bit of oviposition, then that may help increase your yield next year. But the egg laying doesn't always kill the end of the branches. It will kill some of them if they tear up the twig terribly. But basically, there's no, if your trees are already being harvested, you're using getting fruit from them, they're going to be too big to bag, probably in some cases. Some people, if they're really small trees and worried about it, they will put some kind of barrier between the branches and the female cicadas. But it sounds like your trees may be too large for that.
Nancy emails that we have bought small netting to wrap our 15-year-old dwarf dogwood to prevent them from laying eggs and flagging the tree. We'd like to know if we should wrap a 30-year-old azalea bush or a very small Boudea butterfly bush planted last fall.
I have seen that if your plants have woody stems, the cicadas may lay eggs in those bushes. You can wrap them, but again, you don't want to wrap them up like a giant Q-tip. You want to give them an opportunity to breathe. You know, because if you wrap them up too tightly, that could actually interfere with their growth. It's not recommended that you spray, but mostly if you keep a barrier. But remember, most female cicadas are looking for a tree that's going to survive for 17 years. It's usually a mature tree in full sunlight, surrounded by low vegetation. That's one of the reasons why we're seeing them actually increasing in urban areas. One of the great cicada workers, Monty Lloyd, published a paper, Why Are Cicadas More Common in Cities? He realized that we were creating essentially a cicada Shangri-La with these isolated trees and full sunlight in the backyard with low vegetation. That was just luring in cicadas like crazy.
Oh, man. See, I thought I was going to be kind of spared because I live in downtown Covington, but we do have some trees that live in the sunlight. So they're going to come to Pike mm-hmm. Street, aren't they?
Probably. I was in 2004. I was down in Newport. They were just really screaming down there. It was really fun.
Oh, great. All right. Let's go back to the phone lines. We find Sarah. Hi, Sarah. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thanks so much for taking my call. I had a question concerning the cicada killer wasp. Back in 2004, I had the unique experience of watching them harvest the cicadas when Brood 10 came out up in Warren Dunes State Park in Michigan. And I was just curious what the life cycle is of the cicada killer wasp related to when we have a very large cicada population happen.
All right, Sarah, thanks for the call.
Certainly, well, the cicada killer wasp is a big looking wasp. I mean, you've really got to get in their face to get them really angry to come after you and sting you. But the cicada killer wasps are adapted to kill and provision their nest with annual cicadas. They tend to come out in July, usually after usually after the periodical cicadas are gone, and just as the annual cicadas are to come out. I have personally in my 45 years never seen a periodical cicada taken by a cicada killer wasp, but I'm sure it happens because every once in a while, if you have we're going to have this week a cold spell, and if that pushes that back, the emergence back a couple, 2-3 weeks, you could have an overlap. But mostly the cicada killers go after the annual cicadas.
All right, thanks for that call, Sarah. Let's go now to Don. Hi, Don. What's your question or comment?
Hello. If I understand correctly, cicadas undergo a dramatic change within their body between living underground and emerging as adults. They lose their mouth and they have wings. Has anyone postulated how they're able to undergo such a dramatic change and what triggers it, what controls it?
Thanks for the call, Don. I think Dr. Kritsky might know the answer to that.
Well, you're talking about that it's not a metamorphosis as was defined in the insects like butterflies and beetles, where they have a pupal stage. They have what's generally called an incomplete metamorphosis, but it is a restructuring. If you look at the mouth parts, they're pretty similar. The wings, of course, are not present in the nymphs as well. But this is one of the great one of the reasons why insects as a group are able to do so well, especially when you consider that 85% of all the insects have a complete metamorphosis. Cicadas belong to that 15% that don't have that complete metamorphosis, and that the metamorphosis, that restructuring, allows the adult to not necessarily compete with the immature for resources. And so that's quite highly adaptive for insects.
We got an email from Sony asking about, I have a small dog that loves to eat insects and bugs. Are cicadas poisonous to dogs?
Cicadas are not poisonous to dogs. However, you know your own dog. If you have a dog that just cannot stop eating these things, if you put your plate of food out there and it eats all the food, and if you've got another cat and it's got food out there, it'll eat that too. They just gorge themselves. And if they eat too many cicadas, it can cause obstruction in the digestive tract. That can be a concern. So if they eat half a dozen or so, that's not going to be a big deal. But if they gorge themselves on cicadas, that could lead to bowel obstruction.
I want to ask before we let you run, Dr. Kritsky, I know you're talking to a lot of people about cicadas these days and tracking them closely, but when I think back in history, before they had technology and strong communication systems, what did people think about cicadas? What did they know about them as they would emerge suddenly and then disappear for many years?
Well, the oldest record of periodical cicadas is back in 1634 when they emerged in Plymouth Colony. And the pilgrims just thought, oh, what is this? These strange flies, a sort of size of wasps and bumblebees. And they really didn't get a good handle on what they were in their biology for a good century and a half. And that's when Linnaeus of the man that developed the way that we name species with the genus and a species name, when his disciple Per Kalm came over and observed what was going on. Then they realized they were cicadas, and cicadas are in Europe. They're well known. So that made it a little less mysterious. What was really crazy was this long life cycle where they disappear for 17 years.
The Brood 10 Cicada podcast premieres next Tuesday, April 27th. It's hosted by WVXU reporter Corey Sharber and our friend Dr. Gene Kritsky from Mount St. Joseph University. We've got details about it at WVXU.org. It's a 10-part series that will tell you everything you need to know throughout the cicada emergence of Brood 10. Dr. Kritsky, a fascinating conversation. Thank you for spending some more time with us in addition to being a part of that podcast. We've got more details about that app as well at WVXU.org. So thank you, Dr. Kritsky. Great.
But thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And now we want to tell you about a new song that we're debuting a little bit of right here on WVXU. You know the Paul Simon classic, 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. Well, in honor of the coming cicada invasion, we present The Brooders and their new single, 50 Ways to Duck and Cover.
Problem is not inside your head, she said to me. Cicada surface, it's just entomology. Might I suggest, despite your quest to be pest free, there will be 50 days with bugs a hover. She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. I said, but in this case, the X refers to a brood. I hope there's 50 ways to duck and cover. 50 ways to duck and cover. Just pop in a screen, Gene. Sit tight in your place, Grace. Or get the heck out of Dodge, Roger. Just set yourself free. Find a beekeeper's hat, Pat. Might need a cool van. Just drive on through.
All right, that's a little taste of 50 Ways to Duck and Cover. Quite a jam there by The Brooders. You'll be hearing more of that song throughout the cicada emergence here on WVXU, particularly during our upcoming fun drive, and I'm sure we'll be posting it on our various social media. Obviously, that song was inspired by Paul Simon's 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. The idea was from our very own Sherry Mancini, the instruments and production by Jordan Arbenz, and the lead vocals and lyrics by Jason Arbenz, guest vocals by Julie Spangler. So thank her. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. Our theme music is composed by Rob Fetters. You can find archives of our program online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.